Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 4, The Characteristics of Rishabhadev, Text 6. I'll just read the first line of the Sanskrit and we can chant the main part of the sloka. Yashaha Pandaveya Shloka Vudaharanti. Konu Takamarajashe. Nabe Anvacharet Puman. Apatyatamagadyasya. Harishuddena Karmana. Konu Takamarajashe. Nabir Anvacharit Puman Apachyatamagad Yasya Harishuddena Karmana Konu Tat Karma Rajashe Nabir Anvacharit Puman Apachyatamagad Yasya Harishuddena Karmana Vaishnavis. Pandaveya, O Maharaj Parichit. Shloka, two verses. Udaharanti, recite. Ka, who? Nu, then. Tut, that. Karma, work. Rajarishe, of the pious king. Nabhe, nabi. Anu, following. Acharit, could execute. Puman, a man. Apachyatam, sonhood. Agat, accepted. Yasya, whose. Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Shuddena, pure, executed in devotional service. Karmana, by activities. Translation. O Maharaj Parichit, To glorify Maharaj Nabhi, the old sages composed two verses. One of them is this. Who can attain the perfection of Maharaj Nabhi? Who can attain his activities? Because of his devotional service, the Supreme Personality of Godhead agreed to become his son. Purport. The words Shuddhena Karmana are significant in this verse. If work is not carried out in devotional service, it is contaminated by the modes of material nature. That is explained in Bhagavad Gita. Yadyata karmano nyatra lokayam karma bandhana. Activities performed only for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord are pure and are not contaminated by the modes of material nature. All other activities are contaminated by the modes of ignorance and passion as well as goodness. All material activities meant for satisfying the senses are contaminated, and Maharaj Nabhi did not perform anything contaminated. He simply executed his transcendental activities even when performing yajna. Consequently, he obtained the Supreme Lord as his son. Om Agana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The sages are glorifying Maharaj Nabhi. First of all, because of his activities, the way he lived his life. And secondly, because look at his son, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Rishabhdev, consented to become the son of Maharaj Nabhi. How did that sonhood of Rishabhdev, Lord Rishabhdev, come about? Maharaj Nabhi didn't have any children. He wanted a son. So the sadhus, the brahmanas, performed a yajna. And by their brahmana activities, which were focused on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they were able to actually attract the presence of the Supreme Lord to their yajna. This is Maharaj Nabhi's greatest fortune, that he had advisors of that caliber who could perform a yajna with such quality that the Supreme Personality of Godhead manifested. But these sadhus were a little embarrassed. My Lord, our Lord, we have disturbed you. We have called you from Vaikuntha to appear at this yajna just because Maharaj Nabhi wants a son. We're very embarrassed because of this. Maharaj Nabhi, he's like someone who approaches a rich man and just asks for a few grains. He obviously doesn't know what he's doing. We shouldn't be disturbing you in this way. The standard of pure bhakti is elucidated in the purport. Srila Prabhupada takes the opportunity to point out that an actual pure devotee doesn't want to disturb the Supreme Personality of Godhead just for his own darshan. I want to see, I want to see, where are you? Just see how sublime this principle is. We think that the highest thing is to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But pure devotion, as demonstrated by Lord Chaitanya, means I may see you, I may not see you, but I am your servant eternally. You are my worshipful Lord, no matter what. Srimad Bhagavatam is a Rasa Shastra, and in the purports, Srila Prabhupada constantly brings out the ecstasies of pure devotion, as demonstrated by Lord Chaitanya. Maharaj Nabi wanted a son. In fact, why not? Why just a son? What about a son that's like the Supreme Personality of Godhead? This is not a pure desire. Lord Chaitanya teaches us Mama Janmani Janmani Srede Bhavatar Bhaktir Tiki. I don't want good family life. I don't want popularity. I don't want the results of punya, pious activities. In fact, I don't even mind taking birth again and again in this world as long as I have service to my worshipful Lord. Now the question is, since Maharaj Nabi's desire was a little embarrassing to the sadhus who arranged the yajna, why did the Supreme Personality of Godhead appear? And not only appear, but agree to become his son? The answer is the kindness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was not required to appear, and as the sages pointed out, it's not actually the ritual or the yajna procedures in of themselves that attracted the presence of the Supreme Lord. It was the bhakti. Nevertheless, out of humility, the sages felt embarrassed for themselves. Not only embarrassed because of Nabi wanting a son, but they presented themselves to the Supreme Lord as fruitive brahmanas. Brahmanas who are simply performing yajnas for elevation to the heavenly planets, for punya, as opposed to brahmanas who were pure devotees. They presented themselves humbly like that. Nevertheless, remember, because of their devotion, they were able to attract the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nabi wanted a son, and in one sense, there's nothing unusual about that. He's a king. And eventually, you're going to see that he fulfills his desire to retire from ruling, and both he and his wife go to Bhadarakashram. And there in Bhadarakashram, Maharaj Nabi joyfully performs austerities. That's always something to bear in mind about devotional service. We should not perform devotional service with a grudge. Why do I have to do this? Another day of this service, how long can I take it? No one is appreciating me, no one is recognizing me. I'm not in charge, so why do I have to do this? Like the materialists say, another day, another dollar. So similarly we can say, another day, more seva. And sometimes you hear devotees have an anxiety that you don't find in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. They come up with a very interesting concept that there could be such a thing as too much service to Krishna. Now, you haven't found any warning in Bhagavad Gita about too much service. And remember that by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we are drowning in the flood of love of Krishna. So what is that flood of love of God? That flood of love of God means the flood of devotional service. So we want to drown. Now, The fact is, you have to apply yourself to devotional service with intelligence, but don't blame the service for our own shortcomings. We need to learn how to take care of ourselves while doing devotional service, how to maintain our health, maintain our sadhana. So any shortcoming in that department is usually our own fault. So we shouldn't take out our own shortcomings on devotional service. The problem was service. And the solution is quite obvious. Out goes the service, and then you have balance. No, we want to humbly admit that in the flood of devotional service set forth by Lord Chaitanya, we want to drown, but at the same time we have to learn how to cope with that flood. While drowning in that flood of devotional service, we want to learn how to navigate properly, how to swim, and so forth. So therefore, instead of moaning and groaning to Krishna, why all this service? We beg Krishna, please teach me how to deal with all this service. It's a completely different approach. So, remember, Maharaj Nabi and his wife, they went to Bhadrakashrama, and he joyfully performed austerities. Now just think, he's a king with power and majesty that nothing today can compare to. Yet he drops it all and goes to Bhadrakashrama to perform austerities. Happily he does that. So that teaches us something about how we should perform devotional service. We should first of all be very eager for service according to our capacity. Our ashram, the different ashrams perform devotional service in different styles, but still the yearning, the inner yearning is the same. When will I be an actual servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? When will I actually be a servant of the servant? The yearning, the hankering is the same in all the ashrams. In other words, the internals are the same, although the externals differ in style. Maharaj Nabi demonstrates by his attitude that he always wants to be immersed in bhakti. He's grateful for the opportunity. He's joyfully executing his service. Remember what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. Susukam kartam avyayam. Devotional service is joyfully performed. Our senses are joyfully engaged in the spiritual sense objects. We interact with the spiritual sense objects for Krishna's pleasure. Another thing to note in this verse today is the sense of wonder that the sages are expressing. We began to describe this. Who can attain the perfection of Maharaj Nabi? Who can attain his activities? We should always have this sense of wonder as we serve Krishna according to our style and capacity in the association of devotees. Every day should be a sense of wonder. Isn't it amazing that I have a chance to chant Hare Krishna? Isn't it amazing that I can render some kind of service to Krishna? Isn't that miraculous that I'm in the society of devotees, able to connect to the parampara and do some kind of service, whether it looks big or small? If we lose that sense of wonder, then that's a good sign that we're doing something wrong. Every day should be exciting. And we should always feel, I don't have enough time to explore all the wonders of bhakti. The ocean is bottomless. So a devotee should have that feeling of wondrously drowning in the ocean of bhakti. I'll never get to the bottom of this. I'll never master it. You see, the material world gives you the contaminated desire to want to master something. Like when you go to school and study something, I'm on top. I've got it all understood. Or it could be just some practical skill of maneuvering in the material world. I know how to travel. I know all the airlines. I can tell you that the distance between the seat and the next seat in front of it. I can actually tell you that. Just see how expert I am. Every ashram has its potential for your feeling expert, like you're on top of it all. So that sense of mastery we feel, we feel entitled to that. It's a part of life, especially as you get older. You're not a foolish teenager anymore. You're not a dreamy person in your 20s. You have both feet on the ground, and you've seen it all, been there, done that. You've mastered life. But actually, a devotee is always a student, just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu presented himself. Guru More Mukhadek. My spiritual master said, I'm a fool. He chastised me and told me, just chant Hare Krishna. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is demonstrating how to always see oneself as a student, as a spiritual child in the presence of superiors. We want to feel that every day brings new experiences, new realizations. The glory of bhakti is such that you can look back at what you did last year, or you can look at your consciousness of last year and you're aghast. Oh, I was really out of it last year. Because you're always moving upward in bhakti. So even just the year before, you're amazed. How could I have been in such low consciousness? How could I have treated devotees in such a rough way or insensitive way? Or how could I have been so insensitive to Krishna's service and Krishna's sense gratification? How dull I was. So each year, you go on like that. Oh, last year, I just didn't know anything. I was so out of sync, so out of tune. So eternally, one feels that there is unlimited more Krishna consciousness to have. And our acharyas are actually doing service to make sure that you can see the ever-expanding ocean of bhakti. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan, they're always, as Srinivas Acharya describes, working to expand the limits of the ocean of bliss. Of course, the ocean of bliss is in of itself unlimited and infinitely expanding. But how do we see that? We see it through parampara. So by the service of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan and their successors, we can actually get a glimpse of that ever-expanding ocean of sevananda, bliss in service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that sense of wonder is so precious for us. And we should think that if it's gone, what's going on? Maybe we've made some offenses to devotees. Maybe we're not attentive enough to perceiving what is in Krishna's interest, what is for Krishna's pleasure. Maybe our chanting has become inattentive and mechanical. You remember, perhaps, when you first came to bhakti, how everything was so amazing. Yes, you all remember. The first time you saw devotees, yes, they all looked so shining, effulgent. Remember? And then what happened? Familiarity. Oh, we see these Prabhus every day. Another day, another Prabhu. Who's going to give me a hard time today? Familiarity creeps in, and we lose that magic touch, so to speak. We lose that ability to see wonder everywhere. So therefore, we have to pray to Krishna, pray to the deities, pray to our spiritual master that I don't take anything for granted. It takes an effort. In the material world, because people are having such a hard time with relationships, they have a common saying that if you want a good relationship, you've got to work at it. Well, this is more so in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and His service. But that work is actually blissful when we're trying to work on our service relationship. It's not agony. Bhaktivinoda Thakur reveals the full potential of working on that service relationship. He says, actually, any so-called troubles that I incur in the course of serving Krishna, those troubles are actually my greatest happiness. So he's revealing the full potential of the devotional attitude. We want to be mindful of the attitude by which we are engaged in devotional service. We certainly don't want to perform service with a reluctant or callous or insensitive attitude. Sometimes due to trying to perform spiritual life within the material world, we may incur some dullness. You have to be practical. You're in the material world. Material world means influences. You can't be innocent in this world. Things are happening all the time. Influences are swirling around you. Your very body and mind are composed of material influences. Be practical, understand your situation, and take the necessary steps to keep yourself sharp and sensitive. So therefore, a devotee is alert to his own attitude, her own attitude. Alert to see any familiarity, insensitivity, even any grudge creeping in. And let's face it, sometimes in the society of devotees, there are disagreements, misunderstandings, and one has to tolerate rather than get into a huff, get into a tizzy. Oh, that Prabhu, 20 years ago, he did that to me. 10 years ago, there was this situation in the Sangha of devotees, and I was falsely accused, I was misunderstood. It seemed like one thing, but actually it was another. I still remember like it was yesterday. One of my godbrothers went through a bit of an ordeal, tough circumstances in the association of devotees. Misunderstandings on both sides, his side and the other side, and it was a trying situation. And that was 30 years ago. But for him, it's still like yesterday, every time I discuss it with him. The hurt, the pain, he expresses it like it happened yesterday. And as a result of his not being able to let go of what happened 30 years ago, he hasn't performed any devotional service and he stopped chanting Hare Krishna. And if you try to ask him, why don't you do this for Krishna? Why don't you do that? First, you have to understand what I went through 30 years ago. Well, we don't want to just laugh at that. We want, you know, sometimes devotees, you know, go through some ordeals, and it'll happen actually to every devotee. You'll be tested. Srila Prabhupada said that. Every devotee will be tested. So one has to learn how to move on. And a big part of moving on is begging to retain your sense of wonder so you don't become jaded and cynical. Sometimes older devotees can be a bit cynical, you know. I've seen it all. I know. But I always point out that the best combination is the fresh enthusiasm of the new devotees and the mature wisdom of the older devotees. Both are essential. So again, we want to always retain the sense of wonder. Who can attain the perfection of Maharaj Nabi? Who can attain his activities? This verse is composed by old sages who've certainly seen it all and done it all. But still, they have that sense of fresh wonder. Not that, well, we've seen a lot of kings in our time. Yeah, he's going to Bhattari Kashram. He'll probably fall down and come back to his throne. No, they're old sages. But they have such a sense of childish wonder. Just see the potency of bhakti. Just see this devotee. Because of his devotional service, the Supreme Personality of God had agreed to become his son. Now remember, at the yajna, the sages were embarrassed. Nabi's asking for a son. We're sorry that we brought about the presence of you, the Supreme Personality of God, just because he wanted a son. He doesn't know what to ask for. But then there is the kindness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is under no obligation to appear in any yajna, who doesn't need anything. He's poor nakama. His desires are all full. Yet he came out of kindness for his devotee and agreed to be Maharaj Nabi's son. So that shows you the miracle of devotional service. It's not that Krishna is hard-hearted and just lets the devotee struggle to please him and he never reciprocates. Remember the case of Achyamuni in the fourth canto. He also wanted a son. And he offered a very vague and general prayer. Jagadishwar, who's ever in charge out there? I want a son. He didn't have any specific knowledge. But he knew, at least, that there is a Jagadishwar, controller of the universe. So it's like in sports, whatever kind of football, soccer, American football, or whatever, rugby, whatever. It's like you're desperate. You kick the ball in the air and say, well, someone, please come get the ball. So basically that's what Achyamuni did. He just kicked the ball in the air. Okay, Jagadishwar, you're out there somewhere. Hope you get this ball. And what happened? Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu appear. Why three? This is what Achyamuni was trying to figure out. I asked for thee, Jagadishwar. And now three personalities have appeared. Which one of you is the top one? But the three personalities, the Gunavatars, are being honest. Because in one sense, each of the three Gunavatars could be considered Jagadishwar. Brahma actually creates the world. Vishnu maintains, Shiva destroys the world. So they all three honestly appeared. So then Atrimuni got the benediction of a son who was some kind of expansion of each one of the three Gunavatars. From Vishnu came a planetary expansion, Dattatreya. And from Brahma came not a Vishnu Tattva expansion, but a Jiva, a Soma. And from Shiva came Durvasa Muni. So again, in the purports, Prabhupada points out that Atrimuni was not a pure devotee. He had a material desire. He didn't want, or he didn't ask for a son who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He asked for a son like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He wanted such a son. Naturally, that would be a feather in his cap. That would be quite a nice son to have from the viewpoint of material consideration. Yeah, give me a son like the Supreme Personality of God. So that's a material desire. Nevertheless, although the desire was not the best, still, he was reciprocated with in such a way that indeed, because there is no one like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a planetary expansion of Vishnu became his son. So what are we to make of this? There seems to be a gap here. On the one hand, on the one side, there's the devotee and the imperfect desires of a devotee. And on the other side, there is the kindness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So obviously, we are not left in a hopeless situation. This gap in bhakti can be reconciled, or it can be dealt with by the kindness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You see, these devotees, both in the case of Nabi Maharaj and Atrimuni, they were practicing. They were very focused. They were very dedicated. So it's not that all their dedication and focus and spiritual practice was overlooked. Ah, they just want a son like me. Forget them. It could be that we have this conception that this is the kind of Krishna we're dealing with. Although we're followers of Krishna's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who just gives everything away, nevertheless, if we have a little bit of tough time in bhakti, we develop a real attitude. You don't know what happened to me 30 years ago. You don't know how I was treated. If you actually knew, then you'd understand why I'm not chanting today, why I'm not doing any service today. It all makes sense, but you don't understand. We are followers of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, who are giving away the whole store. Yet somehow or other we have this idea that Krishna is cold and callous and not sensitive to our plight. Remember Krishna's self-defense. Yes, sometimes the Supreme Personality of Godhead has to defend himself. Like in a courtroom. The gopis actually took him to court. What kind of lover are you? We'd like to ask you some questions. We'd like to interrogate you. Krishna, please take the stand. Now, there are various types of lovers. What type are you? So bear in mind, while they're questioning Krishna like that, they're massaging his feet, massaging his hands, and they're looking into his eyes, and some of them are trying to conceal their hurt pride and jealous anger, all on the spiritual platform, of course, without a taint of material energy. So it's in that way that they're posing those famous questions to Krishna. What kind of lover are you? And in answering, Krishna explained that I can seem like I'm neglecting my devotee, but actually I'm doing that to increase the devotee's focus upon me. I'm doing that to increase the devotee's devotion. So this happens in two ways. The acharyas point out that Krishna's apparent neglect of a devotee is shown towards those aspiring prema bhaktis, devotees who are trying to become purified and reach the stage of perfection. And this treatment applies to the actual prema bhakti, those who are already full and perfect in their attachment to Krishna. So for those who are aspiring to be real devotees, full devotees, Krishna can seem to be gone from them so that they will think, just see how useless I am. Just see how contaminated I am. I have failed to get the mercy of Krishna. Just see how much more progress I need to make. So in that attitude, the humility increases. And then through that humble self-introspection, in which the devotee feels, I've just not attained Krishna due to my own faults. I am not a drop of his mercy. That purifies the devotee of lust and anger. And in this way, actually, Krishna has done a favor to bring the devotee closer to him by apparently what seems to be neglect. So that's the first part of Krishna's defense. Yes, the first type of devotee is the practicing devotee. I may seem to neglect that devotee, but there's a reason behind it. Then the second part of Krishna's defense refers to those actually established in pure love of Krishna. Why does Krishna seem to disappear from them? To increase their attachment. They're already attached, but Krishna wants to give the mercy of increasing the attachment. And for those kind of devotees, in the perfect category, Krishna uses that example that someone's poor all their life and gets big money and then loses every penny. They never stop thinking about what they lost. I don't know if you've ever met someone like that. I know someone who had a fortune of $10 million and in the financial crash of 2008 lost everything. It's a very special situation. We were explaining in Mayapur some days ago how social scientists have discovered something that contradicted a long-held belief that social unrest, social upheavals are caused by the dispossessed, the low class, the proletariat, the poverty-stricken. They're the ones who are going to turn everything upside down. They don't have anything. They have no hope. Sometimes it is said about India that because such a huge percentage of India is living without living with just the tiniest income, that the potential for a demagogue to seize government power and appeal to the poverty-stricken masses, I'll give you everything, just be my followers. So sometimes it's said about India that worry is there. And as you know, Marx had his theory about the proletariat, the poverty-stricken workers or persons out of work, they are going to rise up from the low class and overturn governments. But actually, we're explaining in my report how social scientists have discovered who is actually causing the commotion in the past 2 years in the world, in the Middle East, in Brazil, in Ukraine. Who's causing all the trouble? It's the middle class. Because they work hard to get to their middle class position, and then they want more. We've got this much, we should get more. It's the nature of material desire. These social scientists were bewildered, thinking that if people would attain the middle class level, then automatically they would become satiated and they would be very cooperative and easy to govern, because we've made it to the middle class. But as you know, there's a flaw in this theory, which any devotee would be able to point out. There's no satiation with material desires. The mistake was, they're thinking, you become middle class and you become a nice citizen of the government. For democracy, it is necessary to be a middle class. They're nicely established. They'll have faith in democratic processes. They will be the stability of the country. But again, the flaw. Material desires are never satiated. The more you get, the more you want. So what's happened throughout the world is that the middle class, instead of being so pro-democratic and nice and peaceful and stabilizing, they're totally unstable because they want more. Okay, I've got a good home now. But look around. What about the infrastructure? Where's the transportation system that's improving? What about the schools? How are they improving? So they never get enough. You can't become peaceful. It is not possible by performing material activities, which are a contamination in of themselves, that you'll be peaceful and satisfied. And not only that, it's not only that the middle class is looking for more, they're also fearful about losing what they have. Psychologists call this the fear of falling back. We've established ourselves, and now what's happening? The economy is crumbling. The job market is drying up. What's going to happen to our children? So they get uptight and angry, and they cause commotions. Yes, they were might have been poor before, or their parents were poor, lived in the village. Now they've made it to the middle class. And so when they lose that economic privilege, that economic status, they become very angry. So we were pointing out in Mayapur that Krishna uses this material tendency to make an example about how he treats his pure lovers. You didn't have me, and now you have me. But then you lose me. What are you going to think about all the time? You'll be thinking about me even more. So that was Krishna's defense to the gopis. I know you're not ordinary devotees. You're not in the sadhaka class. So I didn't disappear from you just so you would feel humble and in that way become purified of lust and anger, thinking we are useless, we didn't even get a drop of Krishna's mercy, I have to try harder to elevate myself. I know you're not in that category. But even though one may be in the category of prema, with attachment, I want to increase that attachment. But the acharyas point out that the gopis protested even that one. Okay, you don't consider us ordinary sadhakas, but are you saying that you consider us to be ordinary prem bhaktis? That you have to do what you did to increase our attachment? In other words, aren't we good enough for you? Haven't we shown our unlimited attachment? What makes you think, in other words, what makes you think that you have to contrive these situations just to increase our attachment. Do you understand how unlimited our attachment is? In other words, we're not ordinary premies. We're not sadhakas. We're not ordinary premies. We are the gopis, and look what you've done. So, at that point, Krishna admitted defeat. Yes, you're not ordinary pure lovers. So, here's the real thing. Here's the real reason. I apparently disappeared from you in order that your pure love would become celebrated. I did it for the benefit of everyone else, so they would see the spotless nature, Rudha Bhava, of your love. And secondly, I have to admit that by doing this, I've become indebted. I put myself in debt to you. So at that point, the gopis realized, actually, he has defeated us. He's conquered us. They realize he has arranged a situation in which he is in debt to us. So in this way, the standard of pure love, like a priceless gem, is polished, polishes, shines brighter. When you can see clearly that the absolute standard for judging actions is Krishna's sense gratification, then everything about the spiritual and material world becomes clear. In the fourth chapter of the Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj Goswami makes a great effort to establish that the way you judge an action is how it contributes towards the absolute standard. And the absolute standard is Krishna's sense gratification. Material life means my sense gratification, gross or subtle, that's the standard. Even the subtlest desire, what am I going to get out of this? How am I feeling? That's why the sadhus at Maharaj Nabi's yajna were a little concerned. This is kind of embarrassing, kind of childish. We're disturbing the Supreme Personality of Godhead just because he wants a son. Why doesn't he just be satisfied? When the Lord wants to reveal himself to him, he will. But anyway, we did the yajna. They're thinking like that. And then Atri Muni, he wanted a son as good as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Nevertheless, the Supreme Lord appeared. Still, Kaviraj Goswami takes great effort to establish what is real bhakti. In spite of Krishna's being kind and merciful to his devotees who have a tinge of material desire, still, Kaviraj Goswami wants to give you the full mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu by so extraordinarily establishing what is pure bhakti. Not Atmendriya Priti. The standard is not what is dear for my senses. The standard is Krishnendriya Priti, what is dear to Krishna's senses. And because the gopis specialize in what is dear to Krishna's senses, the principle in Vrindavan is Krishna Sukha Hetu. Again and again, Kaviraj Goswami uses that term. The Hetu, the cause, is Krishna Sukha, Krishna's happiness. That's the guiding principle. That's the be-all and end-all. Just like in the first canto of Bhagavatam, it is stated, Ahoituki Apratiyata, pure bhakti has no material hetu, no material motivation or cause. And therefore, there's no interruption. As soon as there's material cause or motivation, there must be an interruption in the service. So Kaviraj Goswami is revealing the principle of Vrindavan. Krishna Sukha Hetu. There is a hetu, there is a cause, there's a motivation, but it's 100% Krishna Sukha, Krishna's happiness. So then he begins to describe from three different angles the gopi's pure love for Krishna. He says, look at how they decorate themselves, how they dress themselves, how they take care of their hair. There's not a slightest tinge of vanity in that. They're simply doing it because they consider they belong to Krishna. And so 100% their personal decorations are done simply for Krishna's pleasure so that Krishna can enjoy seeing them. And then he gives another example that Krishna's dearest devotees, they're not thinking, how can they enjoy Krishna's presence? They don't even think of their own happiness. They're not doing anything for their own happiness. They're doing everything for the happiness of Krishna. Yet, even though they don't want any happiness for themselves, Krishna forces happiness upon them. So this is the paradox of pure love, the Rudra Bhava. Although they have not the slightest desire for their own happiness, not the slightest concern. This is inconceivable for us. Not the slightest concern for your own personal pleasure. Not the slightest. Yet, Krishna reciprocates and forces happiness upon them. This, Srila Prabhupada writes, is the paradox. It doesn't make sense on the material platform. How you can 100% live just for someone else's pleasure and not in the slightest worry about your own pleasure, and yet that other person is imposing happiness upon you. So Kaviraj Goswami resolves the paradox by saying, you simply have to conclude that the happiness of Krishna's dearest devotees is 100% lying simply in the happiness of Krishna. And then thirdly, he points out, a real devotee protests when his or her own happiness in bhakti, his or her own ecstasy, interferes with service. Even when the premananda, the pleasure of pure love of Krishna, is there, and it interferes with the seva, the devotee criticizes the premananda. The two examples given in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu about Daruka, Krishna's chariot driver. He's fanning Krishna and ecstasy is overcoming him. His limbs are becoming stunned with ecstasy. But how can he fan if his limbs are frozen in ecstasy? So he became critical of that ecstasy, that premananda, for the sake of the seva. The other example given in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is Krishna's dearest devotee, Srimati Radharani. The ecstasy was blurring her vision as tears filled her eyes, and she was unable to see Krishna properly, and in that way she felt her service was being impeded. So she criticized that ecstasy. So that is Kaviraj Goswami's third presentation of the spotless love of Krishna's dearest devotees. He gives vivid examples to illustrate the principle of Krishnendriya Priti. The ultimate absolute standard for judging everything is not piety. It's not religious belief. It's not Loka Veda, knowledge of local customs and traditions. It's not Kula Dharma, family principles. It's not charity, welfare work. It's not deeds of sacrifice for the nation, for this material cause, for that material cause. In every case, the absolute standard is simply Krishnendriya Priti, Krishna's sense gratification. That means that unless we understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Supreme Enjoyer, we can never understand what is the real criterion, the real standard for judging what is a good action and what is a bad action. That's why Lord Chaitanya rejects any material consideration of what is good, what is bad. Manodharma, he says, mental speculation. Looking at something that is not 100% centered on Krishna's sense gratification, looking at that and saying, well, this is good, this is bad. No. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by his words and actions, illuminated the principle of 100% everything for Krishna's pleasure. In that way, we have the highest goal to strive for. And in striving for that goal, we become purified. Even in our stage of practicing devotee, we feel Krishna is not present to me. I had some experience, some realizations of the blessings of Krishna, of the spiritual master of the devotees, but it's been a while since I've received any such transcendental incentive. What's going on? So when we know what the goal is, then we can appreciate how Krishna deals with us in all circumstances of life. And we have full conviction that Krishna knows 100% what is best for us and how to deal with us. Hare Krishna. Any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, you mentioned that the combination of enthusiasm of younger devotees and material wisdom of older devotees, that is the best combination. What is the meaning of material wisdom of older devotees?
Mature wisdom of older devotees. Older devotees have a wealth of experience. They've seen so many things. They've seen cycles. They've seen phases. Mm-hmm. So one should take advantage of that. Tap into that bank of knowledge and experience. In other words, we shouldn't try to reinvent the wheel. Discuss with older devotees how the wheel has already been invented. So what is their experience? How the wheel can spin better. But that new, fresh enthusiasm of young devotees is very contagious. It's very energizing. And that's also necessary. So the best combination, the best thing is to combine the both. So when you have a devotee community full of youthful enthusiasm and mature, experienced wisdom, and that is a very successful devotional community. Mm-hmm.
Just before that, you mentioned that older devotees tend to become cynical.
They can tend to become cynical. Older devotees, yes, can. It is possible, not automatically. Oh, you know, they can. We've seen this temple president. We've seen that temple president. We've seen the brahmacharis. We've seen the grihasthas. We know what's going to happen. Older devotees can tend to be like that, but especially if they do outreach work and also are involved with training younger devotees, you become so amazed by the freshness of the bhakti experience. So for older devotees, it's very important that they care and train for younger devotees, and also they do outreach. In that way, they're always in contact on a daily basis with the miracle of bhakti. So as I said, the best is that both are there. And then you have a very successful devotional community. I must have been talking about myself.
Also, we read that as we become more and more attracted to spiritual life, we must become callous to material activities, material life. So how do we prevent that callousness towards material pains and pleasures from seeping into our devotional interactions?
That is a good question. And from my own experience, that is resolved by internal endeavor. You actually have an internal yearning. You're begging Krishna, please let me always see the miracle of bhakti. You're working on the relationship. You don't want to take anything for granted. That takes an inner commitment, because as the years go by, we may become mechanical. I'm a veteran. I've seen it all, been through it all, and I'm surviving. Yes, there is great credit for someone who's a survivor in devotional service. I remember sometimes amongst older devotees, we sort of refer to older devotees who've been through a lot, we say, and still they're still standing in bhakti. We say, he's a survivor, she's a survivor. So there's great credit to that. But we want to be more than survivors, hardened, battle-hardened survivors. We want to be always fascinated by the glories of bhakti, the glories of devotees. And that does take an internal effort. Beg the deities for that empowerment, that you can always swim and float in the ocean of devotees with a sense of wonder, with a sense of excitement. It does take an internal commitment. It's often nothing that we can generate on our own. We have to beg for it. And especially when you're an older devotee, you don't like begging for anything. Come on, I've been around 30 or 40 years. I should get my due without begging. But Krishna knows how to bring us all to our knees, so to speak. We never give up being a beggar. And so that ability to not become jaded as an older devotee, it requires some internal effort.
Maharaj, you mentioned that when Maharaj Navi was doing the sacrifice of his son, when the Lord appeared, the sages who were engaged in that sacrifice felt some embarrassment, and they can be explored for this extensively, that's your desire. And then you resolve that the Lord still appeared on his kindness, which was a resolution to that. Why would the Lord reciprocate with somebody's mature desire? My question is that in this verse, they're glorifying Marjanami, and they're saying that by his Shuddha Karma, by his pure devotion, the Lord became his son. So it would appear that the same, I'm assuming it's relatively the same group of sages, they're from the same family of sages. One of them was embarrassed by the fact that he was looking for the Lord to become his son. The other group now, after the fact, is glorifying, and they're indicating a positive relationship because they say Shuddhena Karmana, by his pure karma, indicating that it was by that activity that the Lord appeared, which would go against the principle, not necessarily, but on some level, that there was something wrong with his previous desire. Could you please help me resolve that?
Yes. Bhagavatam presents things from different angles. It's like taking a gem and holding it up to the light and looking at different facets. So the sages were embarrassed, not only for Maharaj Nabi, but they considered themselves to be ordinary brahmanas of fruitive activity. But look at what happened. By their purity, by the sages' purity, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared. So it's showing humility. And it's also showing that, yes, from one angle, you could say Nabi was flawless. Yet from another angle, well, maybe there's a little pinch of something that needed to be resolved. So the Bhagavatam is always taking the gem and shifting it in the light so you see different facets. It's very deep. So from one point of view, yes, Shuddhena Garmana, pure execution and devotional service. From another angle, yeah, a little something that... Here's an example. Sudama Brahmana, Krishna's friend. He went to Dwarka, ostensibly to ask for some financial support from Krishna. That's what his wife was concerned with. Is the wife subject to being critiqued? No, she was simply thinking of the welfare of her husband. But it could appear that she was saying, go see your old friend Krishna, get some money. But remember, she was more stricken with hunger than her husband, because she would take whatever little food came their way, she'd give it all to her husband and she wouldn't have anything. So she's actually thinking of her husband's welfare. But it could seem that she was telling her husband, go see Krishna to fulfill material desires. And her husband was very reluctant because of that. I never asked Krishna for anything. So, you know what happened. In Dwarka, he saw the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna snatched the chip rice out of his hand. And what was Sudama Brahmana thinking on his way home after he left the palace of Rukmini? He was still as poverty-stricken as before, but what is he thinking? The wonder. We talked about the wonder today. How amazing is this? I, an imitation Brahmana, a sinful person, have been embraced by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How wonderful this is. Amazing. That was his thought. He was just in a daze of wonder. And then he said something very interesting. It is further wonderful that Krishna didn't give me anything. That is proof of his mercy upon me. He didn't give me one penny. Because if he knew, if I get the slightest bit of wealth, I'll fall down. So this is further symptom of my Lord's greatness. Didn't give me anything. What would we have said in those circumstances? I've been serving for 20, 30, 40 years, performing severe austerities, tolerating so many devotees misunderstanding me, tolerating so much lack of notice of my great efforts. We complain. But Sudama Brahmana, his angle was, how loving my Lord is. He knew me. He knew the slightest opulence, I'd fall down. How wonderful he is. He didn't give me anything. Of course, when he got home, it was a bit of a surprise. Now, what was Krishna thinking? Krishna in Dwarka, in Rukmini's palace, was thinking, he's given me this chip rice. Actually, Krishna had to snatch it from him. I have nothing in my wealth that could properly repay him. Therefore, I have to wait until he leaves the palace and gets home to give him something because I'm embarrassed. Nothing I have in my possession can properly compensate him for his bhakti. And that bhakti is demonstrated in those few chip rice grains that I have nothing. I'm defeated. I'm embarrassed. I can't reciprocate with my devotee enough. So therefore, I'll do it on the sly. I'll wait till he leaves, because I can't face him. I can't reciprocate with him. The example the acharyas give is like a farmer does yajna very devotedly so that it'll be rain on his land. So the rain is embarrassed. This farmer is performing such nice yajnas so that I'll rain, but I can't properly repay him or reciprocate with him. So what I'll do, I won't rain during the day. I'll rain at night while he's sleeping. That way I won't show my face during the day, so to speak. So that's the acharya's explanation for why Krishna did not compensate Sudama Brahmana with anything. It seemed like no devotee care. And Sudama, as we said, was exulting in that. I didn't get anything from him. That's the greatest thing. But as you know, he got home and there was opulence rivaling that of Indra. So the acharyas point out that yes, Sudama Brahmana, associate of Krishna in Krishna's childhood when they were both in the Gurukula, obviously he's not a normal devotee. Obviously, he's on an extraordinary platform. Yet, Krishna detected a little attachment. What was Sudama's little attachment? He was attached to being a renounced Brahmana. He was attached to being austere. But this is very subtle. You can't really make a big thing out of it. Yet, it's there in a microscopic way. So Krishna said, all right. You're so attached to being a renounced austere Brahmana? Ha ha, take the opulence of Indra. So sometimes Krishna takes away from his devotee in order to increase the devotee's love. And here's an example where Krishna gives everything. You're too attached to being renounced. I'm going to overload you with opulence. We like that kind of Krishna, yeah. That's really the supreme personality you got here. So my point in saying this is that in the minute analysis of things, there are these very tiny points. But we shouldn't make a whole mountain out of it. Sudama, I guess you weren't up to the standard. He was Krishna's childhood friend. So similarly, in the case of Maharaj Nabi, I've also thought about what you said, especially when you compare Nabi's case with Atrimuni. So my answer would be that the bhakti is very deep, and sometimes within the purview of pure devotional service, that can be a little microscopic thing that one... one needs to deal with. And obviously, Nabi dealt with it. So then, because the sages are always looking for a chance to glorify bhakti and glorify devotees, especially Nabi has gone to Bhadrikashrama with his wife. They've let go of the kingdom. Rishabhdev is king. It's all glorious. So yeah. All glories to Nabi and his pure devotional service. Things are upbeat, you know? I hope that satisfied you a little bit. Yes.
Thank you for the wonderful lecture. I felt when you were speaking about your friend 30 years, bowling we have.
Hmm.
We were laughing.
Hmm.
We said not something to laugh.
Hmm.
About. So I felt some concern about that, and we, many of us, we share the concern for the devotees that are like burned down the devotees.
Yes.
Try to do something to bring them to a point where they can be more happy or more close. They was not there. But at the same time, we are worried about having this kind of devotees in our temple because they are like a bit of a rotten apple and they can rotten other devotees because they are skeptical or cynical. So you can give us a practical.
Yes. Skill is required in dealing with devotees who are very wounded from something that happened in the past. They don't want to let go of their grievances and grudges. And yes, we sympathize certainly with the grievances and grudges. Don't dismiss them because it could very well happen to you. So, at the same time, you don't want those attitudes to hamper young devotees. So skillful management is required. I know myself, for example, I'm often involved in a lot of outreach activities, especially in the first world, trying to bring newcomers to bhakti. As you may know, ISKCON in the first world means like North America, Europe, and especially other places of the world that are predominantly English-speaking. The congregations are predominantly fortunate members of fortunate Indians who have saved so many temples in the first world, who are so actively contributing to the activities. But in terms of the others in the population, times have changed, or we have changed, or we're not doing enough, but there's a real problem in reaching out to the non-Indian population in the first world. So naturally, if you are trying to bring newcomers to bhakti in a place where devotees have had some problems, where devotees may feel that they were mistreated, they were not dealt with properly, they were disappointed by leaders. To mix the two together is not very beneficial in the beginning. So we have to keep that in mind. It's like you have an elementary school or a grade school, you know, the first few years in school when kids are 5, 6, or 7, you don't bring a bunch of high school kids into the classroom and say, hey, let's all be together. No, you keep the various grades in school separate because the grades have different mentalities. Of course, there's such a thing as a one-room schoolhouse. The first school I went to, the first 3 grades, was indeed a one-room school with 3 grades in one room. But the teacher has to be very expert then. Outreach requires expertise in building a devotional community. Because yes, you have to manage the freshness and newness of the newcomers. Of course, first of all, there has to be some newcomers. Otherwise, you don't have this problem. But we want this problem. We want newcomers. Remember, those of you from the first world, besides the wonderful Indian congregation, we do want some others to come, right? Okay. So, the situation has to be managed. Give the newcomers a chance to grow in bhakti, just like the old quote-unquote burnout cases had. They had their chance. So give the newcomers a chance. If you want to match the cynicism of such jaded older devotees, you can say, look, Prabhu, give them a chance to become burned out. Let them go through their enthusiastic phase, and then later when they burn out, then... But of course, we don't want anyone to burn out, and there's no need for anyone to burn out. Guidance is required at every stage of bhakti, both when you're a young devotee and when you're an old devotee. Without guidance, you will hit a speed bump and you'll be thrown out of the vehicle. So those speed bumps let you know that at every stage in bhakti, guidance is required, whether you're young or old. As soon as you start thinking you're an island to yourself, I know everything, been there, done that, seen it all, there's a problem. So yes, we want that problem of there being newcomers. In the first world, we would like to see that problem. If we've got newcomers, what are we going to do? There's older devotees who've had some tough times, and if they mix with the newcomers, they might influence them. First, let's have the problem. And then we'll talk about it. So I was explaining in Mayapur how in the first world, we have simply concentrated upon the juicy, low-hanging fruit of the tree. That's the Indian congregation. And they are auspicious, they're fortunate, they're blessed. But it's time now to start advancing up the tree. We are very appreciative and thankful to the low-hanging fruit. Very juicy, very tasty. Very auspicious. But there are other branches on the tree that are not as accessible, but still, this is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. ISKCON began in the first world, but in terms of outreach in the first world, we have to say, honestly, that ISKCON is floundering in terms of first world outreach, beyond the Indian congregation. So yes, we'd like to see that problem of newcomers. It's a welcome problem. Yes. Of course, the only way to connect with the Krishna Sukha Hetu, the cause, the motivation being Krishna's happiness, the only way to connect to that is through the happiness of the parampara. By pleasing Krishna's devotee, that's the best way to give Krishna pleasure. Otherwise, Krishna's not...